Welcome back, everyone, to The Deep Dive. We're diving into a case today that's been making waves in the legal world for well over a decade. Bell Atlantic Corp. v. Twombly.
Yeah, a real game changer.
It really is. And you know what's wild about it? Is it didn't just impact antitrust law. Its effects are being felt in every federal case filed today.
Absolutely. It's one of those landmark decisions every lawyer and law student should know inside and out.
Couldn't agree more. Because before Twombly pleading a case in federal court, was pretty straightforward, you know?
Like an open door.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But Twombly threw up this new hurdle, raising the bar for what counts as a valid claim.
You could say that, yeah.
So let's set the stage for our listeners. We're talking about the telecom world after that big Telecommunications Act of 96. Remember that one?
Okay.
It was all about bringing more competition into the industry.
Right. We had those giant ILFCs, the incumbent local exchange carriers, think Verizon, AT&T.
The big guys. And then you had the CLECs, the competitive local exchange carriers trying to break into the market.
David versus Goliath situation.
Exactly. And the plaintiffs in Twombly, a bunch of subscribers, they claim these ILAs were conspiring to keep those CLECs down.
Trying to squash the competition.
Yeah. They said the ILAs were using all these shady tactics, like blocking access to their networks and carving up territories to avoid going head-to-head.
Classic anti-competitive behavior. But here's the thing.
What's that?
They didn't have a smoking gun. No hard evidence of an actual agreement. Just a lot of suspicious activity.
So they built their case around this idea of parallel conduct.
Right.
Meaning the ILACs were all acting in a similar way.
Exactly. Like, take Quest. They decided not to enter the California market, even though they were operating in nearby states.
Seemed kind of fishy.
Yeah. And for decades, the standard for pleading a case was based on this 1957 decision, Conley v. Gibson. Remember that? No set of facts test.
Vaguely.
It basically meant a complaint could survive dismissal, unless it was totally impossible to imagine AIDWI facts that could support the claim.
So even if the allegations were a bit vague, as long as they weren't completely out there,
right,
the case could move on to discovery.
Precisely. But then came Twombly, and everything changed.
Yeah, Twombly introduced this whole new standard plausibility.
Right. It wasn't enough for a claim to be just conceivable. The complaint had to have factual allegations that made the claim plausible.
And that's where Justice Souter's famous line comes in. A claim requires factual allegations plausibly suggesting agreement, not merely consistent with it.
It's a mouthful, but it's key.
So what does that mean in plain English?
Well, it's about connecting the dots. You can't just say they conspired. You need to show how and why it makes sense.
And this wasn't about some simple market like gas stations or grocery stores. This was complex telecom.
Right. Applying that new plausibility standard, the court said simply alleging parallel conduct wasn't enough to prove a conspiracy.
Because businesses can act in similar ways for totally legitimate reasons.
Exactly. Like all those gas stations lowering their prices at the same time could be collusion, but it could also just be competition doing its thing.
It's like that saying, right? If you see a turtle on a fence post,
mm-hmm,
you know, it didn't get there by itself.
Exactly. You need more context. Those telltale signs that point to an agreement.
So in Twombly, the court was saying, show me the agreement. Don't just allege the outcome.
Yep. Show me the how and the why, not just the what.
So let's say I'm a lawyer and I'm drafting a complaint after Twombly. What kind of details would make my allegations more likely to hold up?
Think of it like building a case, you know? You need those specific pieces of evidence that fit together to form a plausible picture of an agreement. Dates and locations of those key meetings, for example. Or evidence of any unusual market behavior that deviates from the norm.
So instead of just saying they conspired, I need to say something like, on this specific date, these executives met in this city and right after we saw this anti-competitive action.
Exactly. And, you know, don't forget about financial incentives. Was there a reason for these companies to collude? Did they have a history of working together? Were there industry-specific factors that made it easier for them to coordinate?
It's like those crime dramas where you see detectives connecting the dots on a whiteboard. You have to do the same thing for the judge. Show them that a conspiracy is the most likely explanation for what went down.
Right. Now, as you might imagine, this shift from possibility to plausibility was huge. It wasn't just about antitrust. Quambly's plausibility standard started showing up in all sorts of federal lawsuits.
Oh, yeah. It was a game changer.
It gave defense attorneys a powerful new weapon, motions to dismiss under Rule 12b-6. They could argue that a complaint lacked factual enhancement and try to get it thrown out before discovery even started.
Wow. So did Twombly make it harder for some plaintiffs to get their day in court? like those who might not have all the evidence up front and were hoping to find more during discovery?
That's exactly what Justice Stevens argued in his dissent. He was worried that Twombly would gut the idea of notice pleading, you know, that principle that's supposed to make the legal system more accessible.
He had a point there.
He believed that plaintiffs should have a fair shot at gathering evidence before a case is dismissed. He was concerned that Twombly would create a system where only those with tons of resources and evidence could get past that initial hurdle.
So it was a big concern about fairness.
It was. But the majority on the court, they countered by saying antitrust discovery is expensive and time-consuming. They were worried about forcing defendants to go through that whole process based on weak allegations. It could lead to settlements just to avoid the cost, even if the claims were baseless.
I see. They were trying to prevent those in terrorem settlements,
yeah.
Right? Where fear drives the settlement, not the facts of the case.
Exactly. They argued that raising the bar at the pleading stage would help weed out those weak cases early on, saving everyone time, money, and stress.
So it was about finding a balance between protecting the rights of plaintiffs and shielding defendants from unfair burdens.
Exactly. That classic push and pull in law, access to justice on one side and the need to prevent frivolous lawsuits on the other.
And that tension is what makes Twombly so interesting even today. It forces us to think about these really fundamental questions about our legal system, how to make it both fair and efficient.
And while Twombly gave us some guidance, it didn't spell out exactly what plausibility means. There's still room for interpretation, which is probably why we're still discussing it today.
No plausibility meter for judges, huh? It's all about judgment, and different people can see things differently.
Right. And to add another layer to this, a couple of years after Twombly, the Supreme Court decided Ashcroft v. Iqbal, that decision really reinforced and clarified the reach of the plausibility standard.
Yes, Iqbal. That one really drove home the message that Twombly wasn't just about antitrust cases.
Exactly. It meant that those vague allegations without factual support wouldn't fly in any federal civil action.
The court was basically saying, we mean business about this plausibility thing. It applies everywhere.
Pretty much. Hmm. And that's a key takeaway for anyone listening. Whether it's contract disputes, employment discrimination, or any other federal claim, you've got to think about Twombly and Iqbal. You have to build a plausible story with your allegations. Show the why and the how, not just the what. It's definitely a higher bar for plaintiffs, but the idea is sound. The goal is to prevent cases that are doomed to fail from clogging up the system and wasting everyone's time.
So we've seen how Twombly and Iqbal upped the ante for pleading a case in federal court.
But did this whole shift towards plausibility actually improve the legal system?
Yeah, that's a real question, isn't it? And as you might guess, there are some pretty strong opinions on both sides.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
On the one hand, you have those who argue that Twombly and Iqbal were like necessary adjustments.
Course corrections.
Exactly. They say that the old no set of facts standard had tipped the scales too far in favor of plaintiffs, allowing all these weak or even totally baseless lawsuits to just drag on.
Wasting time and money.
Right. They think raising the bar for pleading helps weed out those cases early, saving everyone a lot of hassle.
And they always point to that issue of interim settlements, where defendants feel like they have to settle even if the claims are bogus, just to avoid the massive cost of discovery.
It's a real problem. They say that forcing plaintiffs to be more specific in their pleading helps level the playing field and prevent settlements that are based on fear, not facts.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other side, you have those who say that this whole focus on plausibility has made things tougher for plaintiffs.
Mm.
Especially those who don't have a lot of resources.
They worry that it's become too hard to beat a motion to dismiss.
Yeah. They say that requiring plaintiffs to lay out all their evidence before they've even had a chance to do discovery puts them at a big disadvantage.
I mean, how can you be expected to have all the evidence lined up before you've even had the chance to investigate?
It's like David and Goliath. And the critics say that Twombly and Iqbal have given Goliath a big boost.
They argue it's made it harder for everyday people to actually use the courts to address their grievances.
So it comes down to this basic tension, right? We want to make sure everyone has access to justice, but we also don't want the system to get bogged down with frivolous lawsuits.
Exactly. And where you stand on that issue probably shapes how you see the legacy of these cases, Twombly and Iqbal.
It's a debate that gets to the core of what our legal system is all about.
Are we more about efficiency and cost-effectiveness, even if that means some potentially legitimate claims get shut down early?
Or do we lean towards giving plaintiffs their chance to be heard, even if it means a more complex and maybe pricier system?
There's no easy answer, and it's a discussion that's still going strong in legal circles.
One thing's certain, though. Twombly and Iqbal have reshaped the landscape of federal litigation.
Absolutely. Knowing these cases and understanding this whole debate is super important for anyone who wants to navigate the legal world.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into Twombly, I want to leave our listeners with one final thought.
Remember, the law is constantly evolving.
It changes with precedents, societal values,
yeah,
economic factors, all sorts of things.
And cases like Twombly remind us that even those long-standing principles can be re-examined and reinterpreted.
So it's crucial to stay up to date, to think critically, and to be willing to question assumptions.
Because the law isn't just a set of rules. It reflects who we are as a society and what we believe in.
So that does it for our deep dive into Bell Atlantic Core v. Twombly. It's been a fascinating journey exploring a case that continues to have a major impact on the legal world.
Definitely. And as always, we encourage you to keep learning, keep asking questions, and keep pushing the boundaries of legal thinking.
Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp.
And keep on diving deep.